This is episode number 789 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today on What's New, we're going to talk about the Harvey Awards moving to New York Comic Con and Alterna Comics coming back to newsstands. Our comics this week will be Justice League number 24, Punisher number 14, and Archie number 22. And our summer watching project, The Summer of Dread, continues this week with Judge Dredd, Super Fiend.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
And welcome, everybody, to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
We are doing well, and you have a Marvel book, I have a DC, and an Archie. So we are covering...
We're hitting all fields, you know?
Yeah, we've got a cold-blooded killer, we've got a team of classic heroes, and everybody's favorite, eternal sophomores in high school.
You're going to have to be more specific on which is which, because...
Yeah. Well, you know, Archie, really sure. Archie are the killers. And you know,
right, exactly.
Like that.
That's what I said. I was getting a little
Probably should have been
there,
a little more clear with that.
Matthew, I have some news for you this week. The Harvey Awards.
Love the Harveys.
We'll have a new home next year after a gala welcome celebration at New York Comic Con this October.
I believe, weren't the Harveys in Baltimore?
I believe you are correct, sir.
Yep.
Reed Pop will now host the Future Awards in Harvey Kurtzman's hometown of New York, the event organizer revealed to comicbook.com. This year, the award ceremony will be replaced with a reception, with the awards returning at New York Comic Con in 2018. The event, which will take place on Saturday, October 7th, will honor Kurtzman and fellow creators and comic industry professionals. We are thrilled to host such an iconic award show during one of the biggest comic events of the year, New York Comic Con. Said Reed Pop Senior Vice President Lance Fensterman. We are even more excited to honor the life and the work of the late great Harvey Kurtzman here in his hometown while we celebrate the industry's best work. The Harvey Awards, named for famed creator Harvey Kurtzman, were founded by Fantagraphics President Gary Groth in 1988 as the successor to the Kirby Awards, which were discontinued in 1987. The industry awards are voted on by comics professionals. The first Harvey Awards were presented at Chicago Comic-Con in July 1988. The awards have been hosted by the Dallas Fantasy Fair, WonderCon, Pittsburgh Comic-Con, the Museum of Comic and Cartoon Art Mocha Festival, and Baltimore.
Yes.
So you were correct, Matthew, in Baltimore Comic-Con was the last home of the Harvey Awards. But what do you think about them moving to NYCC?
I just kind of feel like, hey, New York Comic-Con has enough. I like the fact that Baltimore is a true comic book show.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of felt that that was a really good home for him.
I wonder what the story is behind that. You know what I mean?
Like, I imagine you're not getting a lifetime contract. And I don't think the Harvey Awards are such a, you know, all right, well, you're going to have to buy the Harvey Awards. I think it almost is just like, let's just find a place for it. If it's going to be with you guys, fine.
Huh. Yeah. It's interesting. I wonder what the process is for bringing the Harvey Awards to New York Comic Con. I'm sure there'll be more. There's probably more stories about that already, but, an interesting story. I think it's a good move on the part of New York Comic Con.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that we sort of, I don't want to say accuse them of, but one of the things that we talk about is that it feels less and less like a comic book show every year. This, I think, is a move to say, oh, no.
It is a comic book show.
We're still very much a comic book show, and we're now going to be a place that really celebrates the best of the comics industry. So I think for them, from an image standpoint, it makes perfect sense to
yeah.
me. I'd be interested to know if Baltimore Comic-Con is losing them or having the Harveys taken away from them, as opposed to that was just sort of a natural
yeah.
sort of ending of their particular partnership. Because certainly, as you mentioned, Baltimore Comic-Con has a good reputation. I would hate to have them have that taken away from them.
Yeah, Baltimore was one of my favorite shows I ever went to. I only have gone once, and it was just it's a pure comic book show.
And it was you and Officer Barker, if I'm not mistaken,
yes,
wasn't it? That went
yes, it
to,
was.
Baltimore?
And Mitch. That was the first time I ever met Mitch.
Really?
Yeah, or I met him. Maybe I met him or I think I spoke to him, but Mitch and I shared a room in Baltimore.
Well, speaking of Mitch Halleck, of course, we want to remind people that Terrificon is coming up the 18th through the 20th of August. You can go to Terrificon.com to see the panel schedule, to see when Matt and I will be doing panels, to see the guest list. And you can know that we will be there all weekend long, the 18th through the 20th. And I think this is the last show that we'll be recording before Terrificon. So hopefully we will see you there. And I think as you hear this episode, Terrificon is happening today because this episode should go up on the 18th. So today, tomorrow, and Sunday, we will be at Terrificon.
We're going to be there.
Another piece of news for you, Matthew. Alterna Comics is headed back to newsstand. Alterna Comics has signed a deal with Publishers Distribution Group, PDG, a newsstand specialty market distributor, to distribute Alterna Comics titles to convenience stores, independent shops, and bookstore chains, including Barnes & Noble and Books A Million. Alterna stated the announcement that comic issue release releases to newsstands will be delayed 2 to 3 months after direct market release, and individual newsstands will only receive 2 to 5 copies of any issue. So it seems like in order to keep comic book store owners happy as the primary place where you can get those issues, they're going to do a delay to getting them to these other outlets.
And Alterna has been a company that really has been more in the hardcover graphic novel world. So to have them back doing individual issues, I think, is a good thing.
It says the publisher feels that comics need wider distribution in order to reach new audiences, provide a living for comic creators, and also reach a new generation of creators who do not have comic shops in their area. Alterna cited test market data that showed a 20 to 25% increase in orders on issue number 2 of series over issue number 1, in contrast to the typical decline in orders between issue 1 and 2 in the direct market. So they're basically saying, in these other venues, we actually get more orders for issue number 2, whereas in comic shops, we are seeing a decline in orders between issue 1 and 2. Lilith Dark number 1, Amazing Age number 1, Croak number 1, and Adam Wreck number 1 all debuted in comic stores on May 3rd. So those are the individual titles that they have in stores right now, and they are also going to be coming to these other outlets soon. So that's pretty exciting. I mean, I think any attempt or effort to get this stuff into newsstands and other outlets is a great idea.
Yeah, you have to. You have to put it wherever anybody is. And I miss the days of walking into 7-Eleven, Cumberland Farms, and getting my comic books there, because that, for a long time, that was where I got all my books.
Sure, me too. Yeah, so that's a good thing. And it, like things like the, you know, the digest that Marvel is doing with Archie now.
Yes.
That you can get in grocery stores and stuff like that. That stuff is awesome.
Yeah, I will buy any comic if I see it in a grocery store.
Well, because in the grocery store, that's not what you're primarily purchasing. Mm-hmm. So it's just like grabbing those magazines or the TV guide when you go to the cash register, except you're grabbing some comic books.
That's what I do.
So maybe we'll pick up some Alterna books at our local Big Y sometime in the near future.
We could.
It'll be exciting. So there you go. That is your news for this week. Now let's talk about comic books, Matthew. And you are going to start us off with a book that you have been enjoying and is, I can't believe, up to issue number 24. But as I think about it, Superman's up to 27. What is the other one? Green Arrow, I think I'm up to 27 on right now. Flash is up there right now. It's just hard to believe we're this far into. We're a full, is it 2 years now?
Well, for a lot of them, they've been coming out every week.
Oh, they've been double shipping.
So about it's a year and a half.
Probably a year and a half into the new, you know, rebirth era of DC. But Justice League number 24.
Yeah, and I think that DC has done a really good job keeping people interested in the stories. And it seems a lot. It's funny because I've noticed now, especially when you're going through this particular issue, you're seeing ads for new creative teams jumping on books all over the place. Like, oh, a new Wonder Woman creative team. And you're like, really?
So who are they? Run me down what they're advertising in there.
Okay, so before we talk about the book, we will go over. We've got the casting, which is that Dark Days series going through Marvel, which I'm sort of kind of not really that interested in. Wonder Woman is going to have Shea Fontana and Marca Andolfo as the team on this one on issue 26. Aquaman, you've got Dan Abnett. And Stepan Sedjak is the artist. Sedjak is a very painted kind of guy, so that may lend itself very well.
But Dan Abnett has been on that book since the relaunch of it. Has he not? I believe he has.
I think he has been. And I'm going to be talking – oh, no, I'm going to be talking about Dan Abnett on this book. Going through – what were the other ones as I am trying to flip? Green Arrow. You've got Benjamin Piercy writing it, Otto Schmidt, and Juan Ferreira are the art team on that one.
Yeah, so some of those I think are the same art teams, but maybe they're just giving those books a clearer push now for people that are picking up Justice League for these individual titles, which I think is a good thing.
And we also have a Deathstroke Defiance, which is sort of now Deathstroke has his own team. And that looks pretty interesting.
I wonder if that's replacing Deathstroke or is that growing?
It's going to be right out of it because it's going to be issue 21. And Christopher Priest, Diogenes Nieves, and Carlo Pagan are the art team on that one. But what was interesting was I'm looking at this, reading it, going, wow, these books are changing creators really quick. And then you're thinking, no, you're not. That's 2.5 years of books. That's about the average span of a creative team on a book.
And that reminds me a news story that I forgot to mention, but Captain America, when it goes to legacy numbering in the new fall event, our buddy Joe Caramagna is going to be lettering Captain America, Mark Waid writing it, and Chris Samnee doing the artwork on it, which is the Thor team.
Yes.
Which we absolutely love. I cannot wait for that book now. That put Captain America on my list when nothing else would have.
Yeah, and we talked about that going to Plastic City, and we got lost a little bit because the our GPS was kind of screwing us up a little bit. We didn't even care because we were so fired up about that story.
Yeah, I was super psyched about that. So you mentioned creative teams. That popped into my head. But please, tell us about Justice League.
Okay, so Justice League 24. The sad part is that the guest creative team is Dan Abnett and Ian Churchill as the artist. I love Churchill's art. I love Dan Abnett's writing. That's the sad part because they're only the guest team. The good
news, as opposed to the full team.
I would love to have them as the full team. This is probably one of the best single issues of Justice League I've read in an awful long time.
Is it a standalone?
Standalone issue.
Oh, even better.
So we start out in the Justice League Watchtower with Cyborg calling the Justice League, and the whole team shows up, and it's great. It's almost like the elevator door opens, and they all come running in together. You're like, Cyborg, what's going on? He says, something monumental is going wrong in the Atlantic. And he says, to get technical, looks like a superstorm on a non-terrestrial scale. They've been dealing with a lot of the extraterrestrial stuff lately, so it's kind of nice to have sort of a homegrown problem. And he says, but basically what is going on is there is a problem in the oceans in the Atlantic that is going to cause a big problem for the land. And then Superman goes, Atlantis again, that's all we need to know. So then the team get up, and they're all going and flying over to where this thing is. And it's great because the ones that can't fly have the green aura around them because you've got the Green Lanterns that carry them. And Flash is going, that's got to be about 200 miles wide. And they're looking down, and you're seeing just this massive storm in the ocean. And Batman is talking about how it seems like something in Atlantis has ripped back and created this typhoon-type wave that is going on. And they're saying, but when was Atlantis ever covered by a dome? So they're seeing that Atlantis is being covered and protected by this huge thing that is going on. And then Cyborg is analyzing it, going, I read this as unbreakable. We can't do anything about this. And Wonder Woman goes, I smell magic. And Superman is saying, this could be some Atlantean super weapon. And now the Green Lanterns are realizing they're the only ones that can really do anything about this. So they jump down there. Captain America, he's not in this one. So Superman says, well, you're going to have to jump in. So they get down there. And what I really think is kind of a cool sort of leveling the playing field and depowering a bit, when they land on the rooftop of a city, the Green Lanterns are going, we're not in time. This thing is going to destroy the city. So then you've got Flash, who runs on top of the wave to try to break it down. The Green Lanterns build the wall. Cyborg's in there trying to do some stuff to see. He's trying to get to the bottom of where this problem is coming from. And all of a sudden, he is face to face with Mera. And Mera, one full page of awesomeness, looks at him and says, do not interfere.
I mean, I can see from here, and I'm halfway across the room, she's not happy.
No, she is upset. No. And then they're all standing there in very shallow water, and they show, and the Green Lantern show up going, did she do this? And then Cyborg is saying her aqua kinetics would explain, but she's not this powerful. Something's got to be behind this. And she's like, don't you try to stop me, go away. And then Flash is like, why don't you just explain what's going on then? Because we're kind of lost because Aquaman was one of us and he's still a friend. What's going on? What happened?
Where's the miscommunication here?
Yes. So she's explaining that Arthur had lost his throne. I did not know that.
Okay.
So Arthur is no longer the king of Atlantis because the people of Atlantis were angry that he was trying to make peace with the surface world. And she is like, you know, my husband was dethroned. My husband is upset. I'm part of the ocean. The ocean is upset. And we have pointed out it's you guys. So we are going to take care of that. And Superman is going, what do you mean he was overthrown? And then Wonder Woman is trying to rationalize and reason with her, saying, you need to calm down. You need to just take a deep breath. We can help you. And she calls the waves and they smash into Wonder Woman and Superman and kind of contain them in the bubble. And since there is a bit of magic involved in this, they are powerless to it. So Green Lanterns show up.
Now, is Wonder Woman vulnerable to magic as well?
I believe so.
Okay.
So the two Green Lanterns show up, and this I thought was super freaking cool. So what Mara does is, since Mara can control water, she can control sweat, and she can control the water that is inside of a human being. So she makes it where their fingertips sweat so much, the Green Lantern ring just slips right off, and she throws them in the ocean.
That's pretty awesome.
And then the two lanterns are there, and they get chucked. So Flash is running towards her, and as Flash is running, he's like, you know, our four hit harder. We can take this, Mara. You're pretty clever, but you know what? And then before he can finish, she says that, you know, you it's hard to move when you're completely dehydrated. So she dries out Flash, and he falls down in pain, all cramped up. And then Cyborg jumps out of the water. You're thinking ready to finish this, and she gets a water and says, you know, he says, this is enough. And she goes, I agree, and takes a big wave and pushes him. Now she says, get the message and leave me alone. But as the message is being delivered, Batman comes up from behind, and she starts choking him. And Wonder Woman is looking over going, she's choking him and going to kill him. And then they finally get their lanterns, get their rings back. Batman is almost down for the count. And then a hypersonic screamer is activated by Batman. And then Mara kind of snaps out of what's going on. And she goes, I told you guys to back off. You can't help me. If you assault Atlantis, you're just going to bring damage and death and destruction to the surface world in a very prolonged war. And then she's like, that's the last thing Arthur even wanted. And she's kind of looking around going, I don't know why I just did all that. I was in complete control, but I don't know why I did that.
I'm sorry, guys.
Yep. Womp, womp, womp.
Sorry about your rings. Sorry about the waves.
And then Superman goes, your assault really nearly washed away the entire East Coast. Would Arthur have wanted that? And she goes, no. So then they all start talking, and then Wonder Woman is kind of going, you know, queen to queen, saying, hey, you know what? Nothing is worse than feeling that the outside world doesn't believe in your cause and doesn't believe in you and that you're always being second-guessed. Arthur would not have wanted this. We can support you. He's our friend. And if he's our friend, you're our friend. So then they all end up in the Watchtower, and they're all sitting there talking, and they're saying how, you know, you need us to help you fix this. We need you because we realize that you can control the water. And that's a huge thing, with especially some of the stuff that we have dealt with. And then Wonder Woman shows Mara something, and they look out, and I'll show you the picture. But it's basically them looking out at the world and seeing the ocean and seeing how beautiful the water is and what a beautiful piece the world is and how calm it is. And that's why this team is together, to keep that all together. And then Green Lantern shows up and says, hey, sorry to break in, but it looks like the Guardians hate drones. Are just being deployed in Pakistan. So then they look over and say, Mara, would you like to come with us? So they take off. And it was really interesting, because you're like, wow, that was pretty weird that all of a sudden now Mara's part of the team. And Green Lantern is talking to Batman saying, I thought that she was going to destroy the whole world. And Batman's pretty much like, yeah, keep her near us. We're all set.
That's Batman's strategy with all of them.
Not to mention, exactly.
Green Arrow, Superman, Wonder Woman.
Not to mention the fact we're going to a desert place so we can kind of control her over there.
Oh, there you go.
So that is where, and it says, next issue, Gala oversized 25th issue. So great work on Justice League. I really enjoyed that one.
Well, we are going to hop over to Marvel now, Matthew, in a series that I have really been enjoying, and that is The Punisher. Writer Becky Cloonan, artist Matt Horak, colors by Lee Lowridge, letters by Corey Pettit, and the editor is Jake Thomas on this one. Now, for 13 issues, you had Frank, who was battling this organization of drug dealers, and it was taking them all over the place. And this was the one where the drug would like enrage them. I forget what the drug was called, but basically that it was a bloodbath.
Turned your eyes red, and then you went nuts.
Yeah, and then you went crazy. And so it was a complete bloodbath, and it took him all over the place to finally take this thing down. However, he finally did. So now he's back in New York. It's summertime, and he's back in New York, and everything's going to be better again, so we can just expect happy times from here on out. And as we start off, you see Frank walking down to the local food vendor, and you see sort of these snippets of like four different people. You see Frank, who's just out for a stroll, legitimately, not looking to kill anybody, just out for a stroll. You have a woman who is working at what looks to be like some kind of museum or something, and she is telling people, you know, we're closing now, it's time to make your way to the exits. You have another woman who is going out for a jog in the park, and then you have a guy who's working in an office, and his phone rings. So you, for the next few pages, what you get is it bouncing between what the next panel is for each of these people. So Frank, he goes and he goes down to the food vendor who's got hot dogs, and he's like, hey, Ahmad, how's it going? And he's ordering a hot dog. Everything's happy in Frank's world. You have the museum lady is starting to lock up. The jogger is now headed into the park. And then you have the guy answering the phone, and he's saying, I told you not to call me here. What do you want me to do it now? And you see that he's going to be the sort of turning point in the early part of the story. And so, again, we get a few more panels, and this guy saying, I could have used a little more warning. Okay, you guys better come through. You know, I'm putting my butt on the line. And you're seeing that he's being told to do something. Now you turn a page, and it's almost Watchmen style when you look at the art, which, again, is by Matt Horak, who does a great job with this. Now you see four small panels of each of these characters, and you see the hot dog being made, and the woman has just locked the front doors of the, you know, the whatchamacallit, the museum. And so the jogger now is in the park, and of course there's a couple of creeps that are sitting on a park bench watching her jog by. And then all of a sudden, our fourth guy flips a switch on what clearly is a power grid and plunges everyone into darkness. And so now this woman is jogging in the park in the dark. Now the security system over at the museum has been affected. And now the Punisher looks around and realizes, here we freaking go.
Can't get a moment's peace.
He's about to put the hot dog in his mouth, and the guy who just gave it to him says, that's strange. Where'd the lights go? And he's like, sigh. And he walks away, and he gives his hot dog to a homeless man. The first thing he does is he goes over to the park. And, of course, this woman is now being harassed by these two guys. And he's saying, oh, you shouldn't be alone in the park. You know, bad things happen in the dark. And all of a sudden someone says, you shouldn't talk to women like that. What are you going to do about it? He turns around. Frank shoots him in the thigh, right through his leg. And that's where you see the, like, the burst of light where it goes right through this guy's leg. And he says to the woman, run home. And she says, I'll run so fast Usain Bolt couldn't catch me. And she takes off. So he takes down that guy. Then he hears more of a commotion going on, and he realizes something's happening at the museum. And we go in the museum, and the woman who had just locked up had been talking to the security guard, and a bunch of guys in ski masks come in and kill the security guard. And one of the guys says to her, if you don't want to end up like your friend, take us to the vault. And she's like, what vault? And he says, you know what I'm talking about. And so now she's being led down to the vault of this museum, and she's saying to them, you don't know what you're doing here. What's in here? It's only here for observation. And you're like, oh, okay, well, what's going in the vault? And they're like, shut up and open the door. They open the door. There's two guards inside. They kill the guards inside. And now they're inside of this vault area, which has a whole bunch of different artifacts and things in it. And you still have no idea what they're looking for. But Frank's on his way over to the library, to the museum now, and the first thing he does is runs into the goon that was outside keeping watch, who's, you know, making fun of the Egyptian statue that's outside and shooting his mouth off, and Frank just kills him off panel. He doesn't even bother killing him on panel. He gets in there. You see that there's an elaborate security system, and the whole reason the power grid was sent down was because this vault has multiple layers of security, and only by shutting all of the power off do they get the security level down to a level that they can sort of hack into it and get into it. And so you see that the vault is opened with a very interestingly shaped key, and they get inside, and there's all these artifacts in there, and they're looking for something, and they're calling to one of their friends, like, where's this guy? Where's this guy? And they notice that his radio is set out all by itself. Well, where'd he go, and what's going on? Well, they find out in a second, because a sword goes through one guy's eye because Frank's in there, and he starts cutting these guys down, still has no idea what they're looking for. one of the masked guys takes the woman who works at the museum and he's going to make his getaway with her. So he radios to their wheelman and says, I'm coming outside. The Punisher's here. And the wheelman's like, at first, I'm not leaving my spot. This is where I'm supposed to be. The Punisher's here. Holy crap. Okay, I'm coming over. He comes flying through. The two of them get into the truck and they're in this van and they're heading out with their hostage. And the woman in the back now, who's their hostage, is saying, oh, you guys are so screwed now. And they're like, hey, yeah, right. He can't catch us unless he's got a car. And they turn around and Frank has a car that looks like a big old Cadillac with the Punisher logo on the front of it. And he's chasing them through the park now. They go flying over the side of the bridge into the water and the van starts going down. Everybody's drowning in there. Frank jumps into the water. The poor woman is left, she can't swim and she's left for dead as the guy freaking runs away. And so Frank ends up saving her while the bad guys get away. And she's saying, you know, I'm really sorry they got away. And he says, don't worry about it. I'll put everything right back where it should be. And the next day you see that the masked guy, the one guy that got away with the duffel bag, ends up going to his boss. And he's like, don't worry, boss. You know, the Punisher showed up, but it was nothing I couldn't handle. I took care of everything. And he hands the guy the duffel bag. And when he opens the duffel bag, what's in it but the head of one of his other people? It's not whatever they were supposed to get. So this guy's boss throws him out the window of a skyscraper. He ends up splattered all over a car down below. And you see that whatever this mob boss was looking for, he didn't get. And you also see that Frank is now going to figure out what it was that they were looking for, because he shows up to the guy's work who shut off the power grid the next day, and he's got a few questions for him. And that's the way this particular issue ends. And man, Becky Cloonan and company not wasting any time from picking up at the next story. So if you haven't followed the Punisher to this point and you didn't read that first story, which was an epic, you know, storyline, with issue number 14, this is the perfect jumping on point. Frank is back in New York City, and this is a brand new story that just started, so it's the perfect point to jump on. And as much as I adore Becky Cloonan's artwork, she's a fantastic writer, and she's absolutely killing it on this series.
Yeah, I got off of it when Steve Dillon passed away.
Yes.
With his last issue. So.
Well, it was jarring, right? Because you have to adjust to someone other than Steve Dillon's look, but I feel like they have done the best that they could through that transition, and Becky Cloonan's writing has continued to carry this book through. So it's definitely worth checking out, especially if you're a Punisher fan.
Yeah, I definitely need to get back to it. So a book that really emotionally kind of pulled at me.
Just like the Punisher.
Is Archie number 22. We are in part 3 of Over the Edge. Now, the first issue, Reggie and Archie started to argue about cars. Reggie challenged him to a race. The race happened, and Betty's car kind of got caught in the middle of it because you got a couple doofuses drag racing and they have no control over their vehicles. Betty's car gets caught in the middle of it. Betty is now in the hospital. And this issue is gut-wrenching. Now, thankfully, you and I, Brian, have not ever had to go through this with our children. We've had kids. I mean, I've had enough concussions and broken bones and stitches. You have two with your kids to last us a lifetime. And I remember bringing my youngest to the hospital when she got hit in the head with a rock at the hands of my oldest by accident and feeling like my life was ending. And all it was a 3 or 4 stitch shot to the head. I remember that like it happened yesterday. This one brought back a lot of those memories, plus the fact that sadly I have friends that have lost children.
Sure.
And reading this issue by Mark Waid, Pete Woods did the art. Mark Waid, we always talk about the fact that this guy can write anything.
He's good at getting to the emotional core of a character and of really creating an atmosphere in a book.
As I'm looking at this, I'm thinking I should have just picked Superman 26 to review.
Yeah, right.
Because this one is going to be a hard one. But we start out, the very first page has the you know, the heartbeat, and then it flatlines.
Yeah, the heart monitor.
The heart monitor. And then you turn the page, and you have Betty's parents in the hospital room with her, and all the kids are out in the hallway, and she's flatlined. And you hear a nurse going, she's crashing. So everybody is in there panicking and freaking out. The doctors bring in the cart, the crash cart, the defibrillator, and you have Betty's mother screaming, help my baby. All right. Already starting. Woohoo! And you have that moment where Betty's mother starts thinking back to those silly things that you even need to think about or think about at the time. And it's her like waking up crying and screaming as a baby. And
right.
Betty's mother is going up and going, oh my gosh, you need to stop screaming. I just need a night's sleep. And then you see her picking it up and she's like, damn it. There's no diapers. She's screaming for her husband, trying to change a diaper. They can't find diapers. And then all of a sudden, Betty's dad, a bucket falls on his head. He falls over. Calamity is going on because they're so sleep deprived. We all know that.
Right.
We all remember that. And then Betty is fast asleep on her mother's shoulders.
Yep.
And they kind of laugh about that. And then you see that is where Betty's mother goes back to. And Veronica is in there. And it is Veronica's first day of school when everybody is coming up to her going, hey, I got a GoFundMe. Can you help me with that one? Hey, you know, I need some money for this. And hey, I don't want to interrupt. Right. And she's pinned up against a locker. And this guy, one guy is saying, look, he wants to sell his sailboat. I was thinking if you want to split it, then you have another kid talking about crowdsourcing a fantasy trilogy. And she looks and goes, yeah, that's a hard pass. Next. And then you got this other girl talking about, you know, things. And she's like, I just can't do this. And then you see a hand reach out and hand her a soda. And it is Betty. And Betty's saying, hey, you look like you're in a little bit of trouble. How about a soda? And somebody that doesn't want anything from you. And she hands her the soda. And she's reaching in going, well, I might have some change in here. What do I owe you? And you just see Betty walking away, flipping her hand in the air. And she opens it. And then that is where Veronica is at this point. And then you've got Mr. Weatherby looking over at and by the way, the last issue had all of these people getting the notification that there was an accident and Betty is in the hospital dying.
Yeah.
Even worse.
Right.
So you have detention. It says, do not disturb Mr. Weatherby. And Betty is like showing her watch. And Mr. Weatherby is like banging on the thing that says detention 3 to 4. And Betty's sitting in the chair all bent out of shape. The janitor comes in and is like, look, you know, you need to understand. I need to have quiet in here. I need you out of here, Mr. Stevenson. And, you know, just all this stuff going on. Because Betty made a comment to Mr. Weatherby that upset him and kind of embarrassed him. But she tried to help him. And, you know, she's like, hey, you know, it's Southwood. Because he has to make a speech. And, you know, talking about this new superintendent, Northwood. And Betty was like, it's Southwood. And then he's like, oh, thank you, Betty. You may go. And realizing that, you know, he goes, thank you for not throwing me under the bus. And she goes, you taught us to be better than that. Because she could have easily said nothing.
Right.
Let him give the speech and embarrassed himself.
Sure.
And that's where Mr. Weatherby is. And then you've got Archie. And it's really cute because you got little Archie walking on a cliff thing or a wall. A fence, like a brick fence,
yep.
Stone fence. And he keeps falling off because he's closing his eyes. He's trying to do it this way. Betty's there going, hey, I just moved in next door to you. You're the boy next door. And they're talking. He keeps falling off. And then he's like, I bet, you know, you feel stupid because you keep falling off. Well, why don't you try it this way? And you can do this. And if you fall, I'll catch you. But then he falls the other way and she doesn't catch him. Falls in the mud. And she's like, well, you should have fallen my way. I could have caught you.
Uh-huh.
So then they're running around playing football. And she's like, you know what? You know, I've got a model airplane. It's this big. And he's like, I'll be right over. We'll go play. So then she runs away. And then you have a splash page of the two of them at different stages in their life, squirting each other with squirt guns, you know, talking to each other on the phone, kissing. And then you see the car right before the accident. And he's seeing Betty's face. And then all of a sudden you go back and you have the doctors going, hey, we just got something. We have a pulse. And you see everybody in the waiting room all kind of breathing a sigh of relief. Everybody comes in. And Archie comes running in. And they're like, son, you can't be here. And he's like, I really don't care if I can't be here or not. And she goes up and she's like, Mom, Dad, you know, and she's kind of groggy. And he's like, are you okay? We're with you. That's all that matters. And you're with us. And then Archie goes, you know, or the doctor goes, she needs rest. You've got to go. And he's like, and then Betty's like, please let him stay. He's like, okay, Betty, you know, I'll be right outside. Nobody's going anywhere. And then Betty's parents thank the doctor saying, you know, we thank you so much for doing that. And she goes, we got a long way to go, Mrs. Cooper. A lot of tests need to be run. But I think the worst is over. And then you hear Betty screaming to her mother going, Mom, Mom, what's, you know, Mom. And she goes, She goes over going, Betty, it's okay. What's the matter? And she goes, why can't I feel my legs?
Oh.
And that's where that one ends. Then as, you know, I'm bawling my eyes out reading this thing.
Yeah.
You turn the page and you kind of get that snap back to how awesome the Riverdale show was with photo galleries of all the characters that were in Archie. So in this, in Riverdale. So a great thing. And which one did I get for the cover? I got the Pete Woods cover. Thomas Petilli, Greg Smallwood all did covers for this one. This has been a tearjerker. And it's interesting to think that every time Archie puts out something and you, and they're like, this will change everything. It absolutely does. And I'm reading Archie and being sick to my stomach because it's churning up a lot of feelings and emotions. And I think that's exactly what they're trying to do. And they're doing a great job with that. And to me, you and I always look at, like, anytime we talk about ever doing interviews, you and I basically default to Mark Waid.
Yep.
And we talk about the fact that this is a guy that could write a straight ahead superhero story. This is a guy that could write a war story. He's written everything. And everything that he has written, he wrote the best Captain America stuff, as far as I am concerned. And he's now writing the best Archie stuff. So kudos to Mark. Pete Woods, you have always been one of my favorite artists, and I'm so glad the two of you are working together on this.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book. So, I mean, I don't know what else to say about that at this point in time. It's just pick it up and read it.
Yep.
And hopefully with Riverdale, enough light is being shined on the Archie universe that people are checking these books out.
I'm seeing a lot at Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
Because I always flip through the comics at Barnes & Noble, and I will go on one day and flip through stuff and then go a couple days later and see the Archie stuff not there.
Right.
So that's good to see.
Absolutely. Well, there you go. That's your new comics for this week. Now it is time for us to continue with our summer projects, and we are flipping back to the summer watching project for the second of our third watching events for the summer. We are going to be talking about the 2014 six-part web series called Judge Dredd Super Fiend. And this was a series that was put together by Adi Shankar, who was a producer on Dredd 3D.
Mm-hmm.
And also was responsible for, he does this thing called the bootleg universe, which is like unauthorized fan films. And he did the Dirty Laundry Punisher one with Thomas Jane, if you remember from a few years ago. And so this one here, of course, is about Judge Death. And Judge Death, for people who are not familiar, because we haven't gotten into any of the Judge Death stuff in the comics, basically he started as a young boy named Sidney Death, who he is the son of a sadistic traveling dentist, and he becomes a judge and then goes on to become something much more and much evil than a judge. And that, and really this Super Fiend series kind of explores in a very liquid television type of way the origin story and at least seeming end chapter of Judge Death, but we know that that's not necessarily the case. And so that's what this is. And it's about altogether, there's six episodes, but the whole thing is about 28 minutes
long. Yeah, it's a half hour.
Yeah. So, you know, you're talking about 4 or 5 minutes each episode. And what you get is you start off with Sidney. You start off with the young Sidney, who is the son of, in Mega City, there is a traveling dentist that goes around in what is the equivalent of an ice cream truck.
Yes.
And it promises, you know, dental work while you wait and teeth pulled and all this kind of stuff. But he's really a serial killer. Yeah. And so he gets his victims inside the truck, and then he can drive them wherever he wants to drive them. And he pulls out all their teeth and tortures them and kills them. And Sidney, his son, is right there for the whole thing and is also practicing those skills himself.
Yeah, he's driving the van.
Right.
The interesting thing when you first meet them is he's a dentist, but he's missing half his teeth.
Right.
And when you first see him, you're like, that's like a bald barber.
And I think he says something to the equivalent of, you know, their brains are filled with worms.
Worms, yes.
And it's because the brain looks all squishy and squirmy and stuff like that. And so you can see that he obviously has a skewed view of life and death. You know, right in the beginning, Sidney is working on his own patient and he's like, Daddy, stop struggling. Well, that's because he's dead, son. And you see that they could care less about it. I mean, it's just a body.
It's a body.
Them.
They'll throw it out.
But right in the beginning, after you meet them and you see what they're really up to, you see that there are three judges that have stumbled upon them. And the series basically begins. The first episode is essentially a car chase.
Yeah.
Where you have Sidney driving this, you know, demented ice cream truck and his father throwing bodies out the back of it to try to knock the judges off the highway and stuff like that. And of course, when we talk about the highways, there are these, you know, no guardrails, highways
300 feet high,
just super high. Like you fall off the edge, you fall to your death.
Yep.
You know, and so they're basically murdering judges with no second thought to it at all. And that whole first episode is basically about that. And then when one of the judges gets killed, Sidney finds his gun. And he also finds on the tire tread of the ice cream truck a flyer for becoming a judge.
Yeah.
And so he's kind of looking around and he's putting two and two together. And he says to his father, I don't want to be a dentist anymore. And the father says, well, what path have you chosen? And he smiles. And then you see that he's chosen to enlist in the academy to become a judge.
Yeah. And it's not for the right reasons. You're not
going.
He's not joining the judges to where you've got Judge Dredd, who is there because he loves the law. He believes the law. The law is everything. This dude is becoming a judge because he can kill people.
Right.
And the first time you see him as a judge, he is going to what is amounting to a sexual assault.
Right.
And he gets the bad guy. And as he is reading the bad guy, the riot act, and telling control, you know, hey, I got this guy, you know, and they're saying, well, yeah, what he did is only about a 5 or 20 years in jail.
Right.
And you see the guy have like a smile on his face and he looks over and goes, well, I think she's underage. Okay. Add 5 years to that. And then he shoots the girl, kills her, and says, yeah, the victim just died. He killed her. And control, without missing a beat, oh, the sentence is now death. And then he doesn't even shoot him. He throws him over the cliff, so he has a long death.
Right. And so you see that he, once he becomes a judge, and did it open with that?
It was, yeah, that was literally the first
with
time
that, right?
You
and
saw.
And then it flashes back to his childhood. Right. Okay. So it opens with that scene where you see that here we have a judge who is doing this work so he can murder people.
Yes.
And creating whatever situation he needs to create in order for him to be able to murder people. And so he does that. He kills the victim so that he can kill the perpetrator. And he does that. And then you flash back to his childhood where you see why he became that way. Mm-hmm. And you see that he ended up deciding that he wanted to become a judge. And you see that when he's in the academy, who gets picked up and sentenced to death but his own father?
Yep.
And he's the one who pulls the lever to electrocute his father. And his father says something to him like, I've got worms in my brain too. And he says, I know, father. And then he just flips a switch
and
he kills him.
They're both completely
good with it. Yep. And when he kills him, he wakes up from a dream and you see that he was dreaming that and he's back at home and he's getting a call that the Angel Gang has been seen in the wasteland, but not too far from the city.
It was a disco club.
Yeah, like a disco club just outside the city where you know, there's a drug deal going down or something like that. And at first he's like, no, I don't want to deal with those guys. I'm not interested. And then I guess whatever their current crime is, it bumps it up to death.
It said because this is like their 30th offense.
It's their third offense. Yeah, something like
something
that.
Something astronomical.
So it's basically like three strikes, you're out. You can kill him now. And he's like, oh, I'll accept it then.
And you see like he's got a little board where it says like accept, decline. And you see him ready to hit the decline until it says, oh, multiple offenses, the punishment is now death, and you see him hit the fit, and you see it from the back, which
yeah.
I thought that part of the animation, there was some really cool animated stuff in there, but I thought that was probably the most clever part.
Yeah. I mean, we should talk about the animation because the animators on this one are Lewis and Enol Junqueira, and they are the Junqueira brothers are the ones that illustrated this, and their style, to me, is extremely influenced by Liquid TV.
Yeah, they had that. They also, I could see a lot of very old Ralph Bakshi, which unfortunately
yes.
when you do any animation, you're going to go right to Ralph Bakshi.
Sure.
And any of the animation that came out of Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Yes.
It had that very creepy.
A very sort of nebulous
yes.
quality to it where it's kind of flowing in and out of itself
yep.
and stuff like that. And it almost has a little bit of that Dr. Katz squiggle vision going mm-hmm. on too. And so it's a very interesting look. It just immediately brought me back to Liquid TV and just thinking about a lot of the shorts that aired on that. And then you think of things like Aeon Flux and The Head and The Max and all that kind of stuff. It felt like it could have been a MTV series back in the day.
And I'm sure that was what they were hoping to
basically.
Get there.
And again, this came out 2 years after the Dredd movie.
Yes.
Which was 2012, I think. It's hard to believe it's been 5 years now.
I know.
But yeah, so it has a very distinct look. And I think that will either turn you off or you'll dig it as soon as you start watching it. But from a story standpoint, you know, so you have Judge Sidney who decides to take this job on and he's going to go see the Angel Gang, which we have. Have we talked about them in the comics yet?
No, in the movie we did.
But the movie we saw them. Yeah. Played by the dude from The Walking Dead.
Yes.
And so he decides to go out to this club and he gets to the club and the first thing he does is he kills the security guard outside the club and then puts his clothes on as like a disguise, but it's like a half-hearted disguise.
Yeah, it's like you still see the shoulder pads, but it's just covered in white fur.
Yeah, exactly. So he walks in like semi-disguised and he's looking around and the reason that these guys are in this club and the thing that they're accused of dealing is this drug that basically, I think it's called Snooki.
Yeah, and it turns,
or something
you,
like
yeah,
that.
It turns you young.
It turns you young. So you see where there's an old lady who gives herself an injection of this and it turns her into a, you know, a 20-something buxom blonde. And so you see that people are completely hooked on it because it only lasts a certain amount of time, but it turns them young for a period of time. And so the Angel Gang is there sort of doling that out and making money off it and that kind of stuff. And so he's there to kill them, except right as soon as he gets into the club, Judge Sidney is accosted by someone thinking that he's a dealer and asking him for the drugs. And when the guy pulls off his costume and reveals he's a judge, everyone wants to kill him. And one of the Angel Gang knocks him flying out of the club and sort of hits him with this projectile-like blade thing that basically stabs him in the stomach and knocks him out the window and knocks him out of the club, where he is now outside in a crater.
In a crater in the wasteland.
In the wasteland, dying. And he's furious because he can't die. You know, he's furious that he's dying because this is, he's got so many more people to murder and all this kind of stuff, and he's furious. Well, who does he stumble upon? But he stumbles upon, I think it's Phobia and Nausea, who are these two witches, and they see him and they figure out, oh, well, we can use this guy because he's talking about how he, you know, he can't be dead because he's got so many more people to kill. So when he stumbles across them, they decide that they're going to imbue him. And I believe they're called the Sisters of Death. But these two witches, Phobia and Nausea, decide to imbue him with a supernatural power, which essentially just strips him of his own life and replaces him with something else and makes him into almost like a demon where he is now Judge Death. And so he seemingly can't be killed and can take on like a ghostly form and can, you know, morph his body and all this stuff. And it's hard to tell like what is just something that they did for this animated series versus what his actual abilities were in the comics and stuff like that. But basically he is now a murderous judge. And so he goes back into the club and basically slaughters everyone. And that's where for the first time in like the third episode, Judge Dredd comes into the picture. And Judge Dredd comes into the picture because this place is now a slaughterhouse. So he's coming in and he's looking at what the heck's going on and trying to figure that out. And then he gets a call that Rico, who we know from the Judge Dredd movie and we know from that he was a clone of Judge Dredd back in the comics that we reviewed and stuff like that, Rico has escaped.
Yep.
And he's escaped from the mining colony and he looks very different now. He looks almost like Frankenstein now. But Rico has a daughter who is basically Judge Joe Dredd's niece. And Rico has escaped and wants to be with his daughter. And so Dredd kind of gets pulled off of the case of the murder because he now has to go track down Rico. And that's kind of cool because when you see Rico, so they're at this place called McFaddy's, which is like a giant floating McDonald's burger in the sky where people just go and gorge themselves 24 hours a day until basically they die of slothfulness is what it's presented as when he goes in there. But you see Rico's there with his daughter, Vienna, I believe her name is.
Uncle Joe.
And she's talking about, well, where's Uncle Joe? Why don't we go see Uncle Joe? And Rico's like, we can't really see Uncle Joe anymore. Like we're not going to be hanging out with Uncle Joe anymore. And she's like, why don't we call him? He could come and hang out with us and stuff like that. And of course, Dredd shows up and they have to hide from him. And it's kind of sad because Vienna doesn't understand why she's hiding from her uncle. It's her Uncle Joe. Like, why don't we call? Let's call him over here. He's right over there. And Rico's like, no, they died behind the table and stuff like that. Well, as Dredd is searching through this place for Rico, you have Judge Death show up. And, of course, things are not going to go well when Judge Death shows up and he starts killing people. And does he knock Dredd out before Rico finds him, or?
I think it was after. I think. I'm trying to think of the sequence.
Because Rico takes Vienna and they go hide in the bathroom, basically. Yep. And then Rico decides that because part of him is still a judge, that he's going to go out and find out what's killing everybody in this place because he's going to protect his daughter.
Yep.
So he goes out and then he ends up getting into a fight with Death first, I believe.
Yep. Yes.
And then Judge Dredd shows up. And when Dredd shows up, at that point, the place is a massacre by that point. And so when he shows up, Rico, who has already been mortally wounded, is trying to explain, I didn't do this. This wasn't me. I'm not the one who did all this. There's this other guy. And Dredd ends up executing him. And Vienna sees it.
Yeah. Did you kill my daddy? And stuff like that where you're like.
She's like, what's going on with Dad?
Yeah.
And he's like, well, he's dead. And so I thought that was an interesting sort of juxtaposition because you had the very beginning of this series where you have Sidney, who is seeing his father explain death to him in a very in a way that is very matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Sidney completely fine with that and he's going to roll with that. And then you have Vienna, who is not understanding what death really is. And you have Dredd, who is really fumbling through trying to explain that to her. And he's basically saying, well, it's when they don't come back. And as soon as he says that, Judge Death inhabits the body of Rico and basically brings him back.
Yep.
And so obviously that's very confusing for this young girl. But and he decides to take Vienna with him and basically knocks Dredd right out of the building. And you don't even know if Dredd's alive at that point. And then they escape. And so then it becomes a chase story where Dredd has to chase down Judge Death, who is, basically disguised as Rico, because the place where he was made into Judge Death is like a portal to, I don't know, his world or something like that.
I kind of took it to be.
But he wanted to take her there with him.
Yeah. And he can kind of, I mean, he becomes gassy, like a gaseous state who inhabits.
Right.
He's
into like a spirit that can go and basically possess people and stuff like that. And he's going to take her back there with him. And so Dredd has to chase him out into the wasteland to where the church is and have a confrontation against him because he is going to take her back to the wasteland. And in that, he almost gets killed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and he almost gets killed by having his heart pulled out and barely ends up surviving.
Yeah.
And it was kind of gross. And of course, you know, their final confrontation where he used the Snooki? Was that what it is?
I think so.
To basically restore him to life so that he could kill him. And then that would be the end of it. And of course, we know that's not necessarily the end of Judge Death, but that is how that whole situation played out. And Dredd ends up defeating him, but is near death himself until all the ambulances show up and stuff like that. And here you have poor Vienna who's thinking, so, like, I'm going to live with you now, Uncle Joe? Like, that's going to be – and Joe basically says to her, like, you shouldn't put your faith in me because I'm not
– Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to be – I'm not a great uncle. I'm a judge.
And don't mind the heart hanging out of the
outside
of my body.
And don't mind the heart hanging out of my chest. And then the ambulance takes him away and Vienna is left in the middle of the wasteland as the series ends. And it sort of implies that maybe the same – two sisters of death that found Sidney are going to now find Vienna. Because I believe this was originally intended to be part of a series of the Dark Judges. And I think that's where this might have been going. But we only ever got this particular series. And so that's kind of how it wraps up. But it very much in that way is like a two-issue storyline from 2000 AD because it is ended. There's other questions to be answered. Judge Dredd doesn't come off as the greatest guy all the time. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it goes. So in that way, I felt like it was very much a Judge Dredd story. And I liked it overall.
I thought the animation kind of took me out of it a little bit. I did love the story. The music was really interesting. There was some really cool
Especially in the chase scene in the beginning. Yeah.
There was some really good stuff in there. And to me, I looked at it as, you know, yes, we just had Dredd. And I never watched this. I never saw this until I watched it today. This is the first time I saw it.
I watched it last night for the first time. Like, I watched a snippet of the first episode, but when I had heard that, you know, it was someone who had been involved with the Carl Urban Dredd, mm-hmm. that, and also he had done Dirty Laundry, I was like, oh, okay, this is going to be worth watching. And I feel like it was worth watching, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, it was interesting, too, in the fact that right away you see that it's going to be bloody and there's a lot of swearing in it.
Yep.
Because I'm watching it, just popped it on, and I'm like, oh, F-bombs. I got to turn this thing down.
Yep. It didn't pull any punches.
No, it didn't. But when you were talking about the Dark Judges, all of a sudden in my brain, I said, you know what? I kind of like it a little better. My only fault was that Judge Dredd was such a he just showed up. It wasn't even, it was Judge Dredd in name only.
He was kind of like a hulking.
He was a secondary character.
And we talked about this off the air, like a kind of like a hulking, not that smart. Just force of nature, which again, I think sometimes he's portrayed that way in yep. the comics, but I think more often he's portrayed as someone who's pretty savvy and is good at figuring out, you know, the weaknesses of people and stuff like that. So I felt like he was a little bit more dumbed down than what
yeah.
we would have liked to have seen from Judge Dredd there. But, and I think the other thing too is maybe the silliness of some of it and the way it kind of played off in a very cartoony way might have taken away a little bit from the darkness of the storyline. Because it was a very dark storyline.
And it certainly is very 2000 AD-ish.
Oh, for sure.
It is 2000 AD rated R.
Oh, for sure.
So it definitely has that. And it's interesting because now after watching it and talking about it, when we go upstairs, I'm going to be grabbing the Dark Judges Chronicles and bringing those up to read them because I have not read those in a long time. And I want to reread the origin of Judge Death.
Well, there you go. So, I'm interested to see what people thought about that because I dug it. And again, it's only 25 minutes out of your time to take a look at that. So I will put a link in these show notes as well in case you didn't watch it. So you can go back and check that out. So that's going to wrap up our summer watching project for this week. Now, next episode, we will get back into our summer reading project. Of course, we're reading the Judge Dredd Case Files Volume 1. We are going to be reading the Killer Car Saga, which is a multi-part storyline. And you'll notice it's right after the last story we read, but the car right in the beginning has Elvis written across the front of it. And then we will also read the story Oxygen Board. And if you're reading the volume that we're reading, after that, there's a hard stop before another story begins up. So those are the two storylines that we're going to do for our next summer reading project.
And interesting, too, when you were just talking about the Elvis car, as I started to read ahead and look at some of the older books, Elvis is the 50s and Elvis are a huge influence on the old Judge Dredd stuff.
Sure.
And when you think about the time, Elvis only died 3-4 years after or before the series even started. So yep. Pretty interesting.
Well, there you go. So that is your homework for this week. That is going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. So for Mr. Matthew A. Herring, this is Brian LaTenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
I am the law.
The greatest superheroes come to the Mohegan Sun August 18th to the 20th. Terrificon, Connecticut's number one Comic-Con, returns. Meet actors from the Game of Thrones, Flash, Guardians of the Galaxy, Stranger Things, and a special tribute to TV's Batman Adam West on Saturday night. 300 exhibitors, including top artists from Marvel and DC. See the Batmobile, the Batboat, even the Batcopter. It's Terrificon, Connecticut's terrific Comic-Con, Mohegan Sun August 18th to the 20th. Tickets at Mohegan Sun Box Office or Ticketmaster.com. See more at Terrificon.com.